I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new book gives the reader a view into the law enforcement in this part of the world, and by virtue of where its author spent his career from 1975 to 2006 here in Vancouver, it gives us a view onto life in those years in this town. A 30-year veteran of the Vancouver Police Department, Wayne Cope, joins me now. He's written Vancouver Blue, A Life Against Crime. It's a book that looks at various aspects of his career. He's worked in various divisions of the police department, from jailer, desk clerk, traffic cop, to detective. He retired in 2006 and also spent 3 years with transit police. It's timely to talk to Wayne about his career and that which he has written about in this new book. Police officers are under a lot of public scrutiny in Metro Vancouver and beyond. This new book looks at the human side from the perspective of one man who spent his career with the VPD. The book is from Harbor Publishing. Incidentally, for keen readers of the book, there's a puzzle at the end. If you crack the code, there's a prize. Visit harborpublishing.com, or depending on when you listen to this, the solution will be posted. Please welcome to the Planta Online program in Tawasin, B.C., Wayne Cope. Mr. Cope, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Wayne, as a kid, did you always want to be a cop?
As far back as I can remember, I was in grade 3 when they were parading the kids up at the front of the class to tell everybody, all their classmates, what they wanted to do when they grew up. That was back at Grandview Elementary School in the East End. And I marched up there and told everybody I wanted to scuba dive and I wanted to be a policeman.
Did you do much scuba diving?
I do a lot of scuba diving. I've scuba dived all over the world, down in Mexico and the Canary Islands, and I just got back from Bali, and I've done a bit of scuba diving.
Yeah, but policing for you, I mean, that was your career, and you write about it in this book, and it's quite an engaging book in terms of the stories you tell. So there were no regrets in the nearly 40 years now since, well, I guess it's 40 years since you started working there.
Yeah. No regrets. I chose a great job, and I did it because I wanted to do something with my life that was interesting and something that I thought mattered. When I was in grade 3, those weren't the thoughts going through my mind. It was more of what I was seeing on television. But as an adult, I like to think that, you know, I accomplished something in the time I spent involved in policing.
Now, you're quite circumspect in the book. There's some names that you have changed. And you say in the book, not because you're supposed to, but because you just don't want to give some of these criminals that you dealt with any further attention. But I've always wondered, when a cop retires, are there any preclusions on them to on what they can say in their retirement?
Well, I think they're subject to possible civil suit just like anybody else, but it's one little part of policing that always surprised me, that there is no non-disclosure agreement that's ever signed between a police officer and his department saying that when I do this, that, or the other thing, I'll never speak about it for the rest of my life. I mean, policemen are quite open about what they've done and are allowed to be. So, other than the scrutiny of the courts, no, there are no limitations on what can be said.
And are you telling tales out of school with this book? I mean, how do your former colleagues or people within the force still, what do they think of it?
Well, one of them actually commented, I wrote a bit about this fellow who I work with, and he was a very young man. He was 19 when he came on the job. He was a friend of mine and a friend of my brother, so I knew him since he was actually a teenager. And he did outstanding work on the police department, left the department to go to law school, became a lawyer, and now sits as a judge. And his comment to me was, why didn't you just use my real name? I mean, everything you say is, you know, there's no negativity. I said, well, it's tough doing that because you don't know ahead of time what the editor is going to do to the work. So it's tough. And besides, you should really ask permission, and I really didn't want to go through the process of doing that. So I just used a different name for him.
Yeah. So there are a lot of misconceptions about police. You know, there's a great deal of mistrust, mainly in the United States, but also in this part of the world as of late. You dispel some of those myths in the course of this book. I mean, was that one of your goals, is to get people to think about the police perhaps differently than they might otherwise?
Well, Vancouver Police uses a model that's an English model for policing. It's a model that was presented by Robert Peel a couple hundred years ago. America doesn't use that model. The RCMP don't use that model. The model is basically that the police are just members of the community, and the community is just as responsible for peace and safety and good order as the police department is. And the only difference between us and the public is that the police get paid to do it full time. So it's a cooperative effort. You know, in the United States, it's more of a sheriff shows up in town and, you know, tames the city type of thing. The RCMP are more of a military organization. But with the European, the English bobby style of policing, it's more cooperative than any other style.
And when you look at life in Vancouver over the last 40 years, your years that you were in policing, the years covered in this book, what's changed dramatically in the way Vancouver is?
Well, I think the attitudes that we've had towards drug abuse, where we look at it as such a medical condition and try and help the people involved, well, noble in purpose, in reality, tends to draw people from all over the country that are attracted to, you know, that positive attitude. Like, when you go back to Winnipeg or Toronto, back anywhere you want, they don't have the same openness relating to drug activity and the same acceptance of drug activity that they have in Vancouver. And my personal view is that it just causes all those people from all those different places to gravitate here, where we offer, you know, free housing and free places, good places, safe places to shoot up heroin and all of this type of thing. So I don't, you know, there are good intentions there, but it's led us down the wrong road, and so that's my theory about it.
And the proliferation of, say, dispensaries, marijuana dispensaries, does that concern you?
I think marijuana is a whole different subject. I don't really associate marijuana with the hard drug like heroin or even cocaine. No, I think that's a different issue completely. That's a social issue that has to be addressed and dealt with.
But our attitudes have changed, haven't they? I mean, I'm 33, and, you know, I remember 15 years ago, the house down the street was raided because there was a grow-up.
Right.
Those things don't really happen anymore, do they?
No, and that's an interesting aspect there. Well, I was in the drug squad for 3 years, and that was about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was there, there were thousands of industrial, commercial marijuana grow operations in Vancouver. Thousands and thousands of them, and there were thousands when I arrived in the drug squad, and there were more thousands when I left. And at this moment in time, I think the number of industrial marijuana grow operations in Vancouver is virtually none. And it's because of changes in law. It's because of making the landlord responsible for a toxic waste dump that his house has become, and becoming financially responsible for that. It's sharing of information between BC Hydro, who knows that their house on the block uses 3 times as much or 10 times as much electricity as the other ones. All these different little modifications in law and attitude have completely changed the landscape about commercial marijuana grow operations in the city, and to the point now where there aren't any.
What have you found in your career in terms of the laws that you have to work with? Did you find that they were, say, good for you as a cop? I mean, or did you find that you were trying to get the government to change some laws at some time? I mean, I'm thinking of the situation of gang violence in Surrey, these shootings that we're hearing a lot about. You know, I've heard some cops suggest that perhaps some of these people who are less than cooperative in investigation, sometimes the victims even of
right.
shootings, aren't participating, that they ought to be charged, but there's no real mechanism in the law to do so.
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult one. Something that has happened over the years, my personal view is that the courts on the West Coast are too lax in their sentencing of people. So people are arrested for what you would think are serious crimes, and they don't really get a significant sentence. And what that relates to down the road is that the criminals are not really afraid of the police. The worst that can happen is they'll go into the court system and get bail or not, or do a few years and come out, and it's all just, you know, they just roll with the punches. If they had significant sentencing, there'd be a little more fear on the part of gang members about being caught or even participating in the gang lifestyle. There's no... See, right now we're promoting the idea that you participate in the gang lifestyle and you end up dead, shot down on the street, which is a real possibility. But they know that the possibility does not exist, that they're going to do really significant crime, unless, of course, they get caught for one of the murders. So, we just don't have that strong hand coming down on them, smashing them when they're involved in criminal activity. And I think that has its place in our society.
The gang violence that we're seeing in Surrey and elsewhere, I guess mainly Surrey, it seems to come in cycles. I mean, there was a period of time where there wasn't any of this stuff going on, or there wasn't very much of it, and then now we're in a period where there's a lot of it. As a cop, when you look at what's going on there, I mean, have you got solutions, say, in the back of your mind as to how to fix this, how to make the street safer?
An immediate response for me would be just put more policemen, more boots on the ground right now, immediately. There just aren't enough policemen out in Surrey, police officers out in Surrey, to deal with huge numbers of gang members and all the gang activity that's going on. Cars are chasing each other down the street, shooting each other, and there's apparently not a police car to be found. So the immediate reaction has to be, the knee-jerk reaction has to be, let's get some more cops out there. Long-term solution, I just don't have a solution for Surrey.
And so do you think it could get worse before it gets better?
Well, there's nothing to stop it from getting worse at this point.
Yeah.
I don't see any activity. I mean, they're hiring more people. I don't know when they'll arrive. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just speculative on my part.
You talk in the book about the idiot factor. What's that?
I knew it. Idiot factor. Well, you just make the notation, and not many people do. And I say that when you have a squad of people, say there's nine of them. I was a sergeant, so you'd have nine people working for you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people in the squad, regardless of what squad it is going to be an idiot. And a lot of your time is going to be spent dealing with that person. And if there's two of them, I mentioned in the book, I'd like to normally put them both together so that you know where they are and you can, monitor their behavior at all times. Sometimes these people arrive because they slip through the system and get a job that's a pretty good job, and it's hard to get rid of them. Sometimes people feel like the department has done something to them, or they haven't got a promotion they deserve, and they're going to rebel back by not accomplishing anything in their lives. So I get a lot of criticism for that, actually, from people who are on the job still, and I say, okay, I say the idiot factor is 1 in 9. You're saying what? But it's not 1 in 9. It's, it's 1 in 9. But we just wish you wouldn't say that.
So as a citizen, I'm well served by the police 89% of the time.
That's exactly right, and I make that note too. It was an honor and a privilege working with 89% of them.
you talked just a few moments ago about the cops aren't. Are precluded by non-disclosure agreements when they retire. But to the point of cops getting a bad rap, whether it's the events in Ferguson or in Baltimore, or here the Jakansky matter of a few years ago, what's going on in Abbotsford with the police force there. Do you feel that if more cops spoke out, the public would take a better view of their work?
I really do. I think that the vast majority of times people would be proud of the way that the police officers work and interact with the community. I think the police officers themselves are proud of the way they do that. There's a big issue coming up with cameras, and so we have cameras on, in police cars and on body cameras and uniforms and all that kind of stuff. And there's just so many issues associated with that in terms of privacy of citizens, privacy of police officers, when you turn it on, when you turn it off. But my theory is that if they were put on and generally on all the time, citizens would be astounded by the control and the way that officers work when they're presented with tough situations. It would be, in the vast majority of cases, it would make everybody proud of the department, but it's not as simple as that. I mean, there are so many issues associated with privacy relating to these things that it'll be interesting to see where this ends up.
And when we pay attention to the media, to the news, there isn't a month that goes by where there isn't at least one or two stories. But and they use the term excessive use of force by police officer in this part of the world. What do you make of say, how, and this is not just the civil liberties people that bring this up, but, you know, the media brings it up. Is there an excessive use of force amongst, say, the Vancouver police? I mean, I note the situation it was at night and 49th, I believe, in November, where the guy's waving a piece of wood around and was shot dead. Then we hear stuff of all the time, you know, a cop breaking a car window, say, because the person was less than cooperative, or getting punched by a cop. We hear that from time to time. What do you make of how the media covers stories like that?
Well, the media covers stories like that because they're very newsworthy. I mean, to see an incident on television of somebody being arrested in a violent way is, you know, it's very dramatic to see it on television. But the reality is that when policemen go into police academy, it's part of basic training and secondary training and every training they have that there's an escalating use of force when you arrest somebody. If they comply, this is the amount of force that's used. If they don't comply, you use up to the amount that's necessary, no more. So it's really put into their minds from the very beginning. The problem with the whole situation and having something that's newsworthy is that when you arrest somebody who doesn't want to be arrested and the battle's on, that's an ugly, ugly thing. And when people are taken into custody who are fighting, there's no good way of showing that on television. It's an ugly thing, and normally policemen are in pairs too, so they're struggling with one person as well. So their immediate knee-jerk response could be, "Well, there's two guys on one." Well, no, they're taking into custody a violent person who won't give up, and there's just no good way of doing that.
And in terms of dealing with the mentally ill, say, I mean, just take that example at night in 49th there from November. The guy had a piece of wood. And he was shot dead.
Yeah, I just can't offer any opinion on that. I know what I read in the newspaper.
Yeah.
I haven't got access to any police reports or don't know what they were dealing with or what they thought they were dealing with at the time. So I just, you know, as much as I'm allowed to give an opinion, I just can't offer you one that has anything behind it other than what I see on television.
And in the 40 years since you started your career at the police, with the police force here in Vancouver, have you noticed that the way that cops deal with the mentally ill, has that improved?
I'm just trying to think through it. I mean, there've been mentally ill around since I started policing.
Forever,
Yeah, forever. I mean, they started closing Essendale down in 1974, I think. So it didn't happen overnight. I think probably training is a little bit better than it used to be, but everybody's had in the back of their mind, when you're dealing with somebody, we do deal with a lot of mentally ill people. And, you know, even 30 years ago, we had social workers in cars with us and mental health people in police cars with us and go around to help these people. I assume because, you know, as time goes on, we have better resources that we even have more of that type of thing now. But I really can't speak to it.
There's a story in the news on Monday about this one fellow who was taken down in a Mr. Big sting, and because of something that happened with the investigator, pardon me, with the testimony in court and the evidence that was presented, he's been given a new trial. You worked a lot in these Mr. Big stings over the years, have you not?
Yeah, I worked 5.5 years at the Provincial Unsolved Homicide Unit, and virtually every case I can think of was solved using a Mr. Big scenario.
And there's been some criticism over their use in terms of getting, say, confessions, getting people. You're a believer of that method?
Oh, it's a great method of finding out what the truth is relating to an incident. I mean, I did probably 6 or 7 full-blown Mr. Big scenarios. One of them, the fellow at the end of the day to Mr. Big told him, "Listen, I really didn't do it, and I know you know, all of the evidence seems to suggest that, but I'm not the guy you're looking for." So, and he ended up taking a polygraph from somebody who thought was some disreputable turncoat polygrapher, and in fact did not commit the crime. So that case he was cleared as a suspect from that case. And maybe just a couple of years later, DNA evidence found that a fellow in an American prison had committed two or three murders, depending on whether or not he actually did a third one. A fellow in a prison died, but his DNA showed that he was one of the serial killers up here who had committed the murder. So we used it, and it actually cleared somebody. Every thing about Mr. Bigsner is that every case is presented to a judge, and all of the methods that are used, the psychology that's used, every incident, every aspect of it is taken into account, and the judge makes a decision at the end of the trial saying, yeah, okay, you guys, you know, everything you did was all right, or maybe it wasn't. And every trial is judged on its own merit, every case on its own merit, so it's an open season every time you walk into court, and everything that I've ever been involved in has been, you know, the judges have given it the thumbs up and say that it's a good way of dealing with major crime investigations.
Something that frustrated you, and you write about this in the book, is the fact that some agencies in this part of the world don't seem to be communicating with one another. You've been away now from the police force for 5-6 years now, since you've left TransLink,
yeah.
I guess. Have you noticed that there's been a change in terms of how agencies like the Vancouver Police and, say, the RCMP talk to one another?
Well, I know that they make a specific effort to do that, but the reality is the two different police departments, and my feeling is that there would be a lack of communication between two different police departments. It's just a logical end result of having two agencies duplicating the same information. I work in a major crime section where you have a homicide unit on one end of the floor and a robbery unit on the other end of the floor. So robbery handles all the attempted murders, and homicide handles all the murders. We had crossover cases that we didn't know about, and when the walking distance is 40 feet between us. So I just can't imagine that there's a continuous and effective flow of information between the RCMP and Vancouver or any other municipal police departments in the province. I mean, there may be an attempt to have one, but the reality is it just won't work.
Well, what's your take on the IIO, the Independent Investigations Office, and the sort of controversy that they're in? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of people who think that it should be disbanded itself.
Yeah, I think that internal investigations now are handled so comprehensively and transparently that I really am one of the people that believes that the police department can investigate itself. Because from the moment somebody phones in and says, yeah, I didn't like the way that happened, I talked to a policeman and I don't like what he did.
Mm-hmm.
From that moment that phone call is made, everything is completely and totally transparent and comprehensive. And it's audited by the Office of the Police Complaint Commission in Victoria, who offers all kinds of information about the way investigations go if you haven't gone that way already. So I'm a firm believer that the police can do comprehensive and fair investigations.
Is policing a line of work that you'd recommend young people to get into?
Well, it depends on the person, but for me, I thought it was a fabulous career, and I'd recommend it to any like-minded young person that if you wanted a life that's interesting and challenging and offers new things every time you get into a car. I mean, basically, you just go from place to place problem-solving. It's very rewarding when you accomplish something at the end of the day. Yeah, I'd recommend it to anybody.
And you enjoyed writing this book?
Very much so. It took me about 10 months to write it and about 10 months to have it edited.
Yeah, I understand you worked with Shelley Fralick on it. Is that right?
I did. I worked with her, and I brought her an initial manuscript, which was a lot of anecdotes about policing, and then she and I spoke about it. She says, well, it's a lot of anecdotes, but it's not really a book. He says, why don't you just... The only cohesive point in the whole book is that you're involved in every one of the stories, so why don't you just make a book about yourself? He says, well, I didn't think that anybody would read it if I made it about myself. But that's the way I restructured it, and thanks to her, I think it makes a lot more sense and it's a lot more readable this way.
Well, congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
A pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Vancouver Blue, A Life Against Crime. It's from Harbor Publishing. You can get it, obviously, at finer bookstores. throughout the city and, of course, online. It's author Wayne Cope. Join me on the line from Tawasin in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.